content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Randall Rickman again from Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. And the cover story for this edition, which is, by the way, a double issue, so there is a lot of content to get to. Cover story, How to Live Longer, Better, including the anti-aging supplement, experts take, pray, the health benefits of faith, the world's healthiest places, and still have fun. That's all on the cover. And we go right into the magazine and get started as quickly as we can. And here we are at the page called For the Record. And it is a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated with a quotation in bold or a tiny line drawing or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 1,100. Caption explains, estimated weight in pounds of an unexploded World War II-era German bomb discovered during construction work near the London City Airport. The airport reopened after the bomb was detonated in a controlled explosion on February 14th. Just under that, in the right margin of the page, is a story illustrated by a quotation in black from George W. Bush, 43rd U.S. President, discussing the 2016 presidential election in a speech at an economics summit in Abu Dhabi. And the quotation from George W. Bush, quote, there's pretty clear evidence that the Russians meddled, unquote. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Adam Rippon, Team USA figure skater, in an interview with NBC's Andrea Joyce following his performance in the Team Skate event. And the quotation, quote, I highly recommend it. If you ever have the option, come to the Olympics. It's like a fun time, unquote. In the bottom right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation in bright red from Mike Pence, U.S. Vice President, suggesting he's open to negotiating directly with North Korea, though he said the U.S., quote, maximum pressure campaign, unquote, would also continue. And the quotation is from Mike Pence, quote, if you want to talk, we'll talk, unquote. In the lower corner of the page, left corner, is a story illustrated by the time period, 8 hours, 7 minutes. Caption explains, length of the address with which U.S. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi set a new record for longest continuous speech in the chamber, per the Office of the Historian. And that time period again? 8 hours, 7 minutes. That story is accompanied by also a line drawing with red accents of a woman who may be Nancy Pelosi standing at a podium at a microphone in a pantsuit. In the left center margin of the page is a story illustrated by the dollar amount in red, $5 million. Caption explains, amount that a Maine dairy company will pay its drivers after a judge ruled that the lack of one Oxford comma in a list of tasks legally exempt from overtime pay meant their work wasn't covered by the law. $5 million. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Emma Arbuthnot, judge, upholding the UK arrest warrant for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has been living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London since 2012 to avoid prosecution for publishing classified U.S. documents. And the quotation about Julian Assange from UK Judge Emma Arbuthnot, quote, he wants justice only when it's in his favor, unquote. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Susan Wojcicki, YouTube CEO, reacting to Facebook's new video strategy, which could compete directly with YouTube. And the quotation from Susan Wojcicki, YouTube CEO, is, quote, "They should get back to baby pictures," unquote. And also in the center of the page is a recurring mini feature within this feature called Good Week, Bad Week. At Good Week, guacamole. Shark Tank investors put $400,000 into the expansion of an avocado-themed restaurant. Under Bad Week, hummus. A drought in India has led to a chickpea shortage and a price hike in Britain. That was For the Record. Still in the brief, we are now at the first page of the subsection called World, and the headline is, "The War in Syria Has Become a Global Battlefield," by Rebecca Collard, Dateline, Beirut. As 2018 began, it looked like the war in Syria might be drawing toward an ending that few in the international community wanted. Yes, ISIS was on the way to defeat as a conventional fighting force, but the regime of Syrian President Bashar Assad, backed by Russia and Iran, controlled more than half of the country. Barely 7 weeks later, an end in the conflict is nowhere in sight. Instead, the war in Syria is growing like a tumor, worsening in some areas and infecting surrounding states. What began as a civil uprising 7 years ago now looks more like an international conflict where patron states are replacing their proxies. Since February 3rd, the aircraft of four different countries have been downed over Syria. A Russian jet was hit by Syrian opposition fighters. Turkey says Kurdish fighters shot down one of its helicopters. An Israeli F-16 was downed by the Syrian regime after the jet carried out raids in Syria. And Israel says it shot down an Iranian drone entering Israeli space from Syria. On top of this, U.S. forces clashed with Russian mercenary forces who had attacked Kurdish forces backed by the U.S. This dizzying array of overlapping and competing conflicts and alliances has become unmoored from the war that began in 2011. Quote, "Most of the conflicts that you see now have nothing to do with Syria, per se," unquote, says Yus Hillerman, director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the International Crisis Group. Quote, "They just happen to be fought there," unquote. In the interest of getting to all this rich material in this double issue, we will now move on. And that brings us to the sidebar feature called Ticker. In this case, it's in the middle of the page. It consists of four news items stacked top to bottom. Top item, Russian plane crashes. A Russian airliner carrying 71 people crashed 25 miles from Moscow's Domodedovo airport, killing all on board. Snow had been falling at the time of the crash, and questions have been raised over whether the plane had been thoroughly de-iced. That would be Domodedovo airport. Second item, Yosemite's famous firefall runs dry. The firefall that appears when a waterfall at El Capitan at Yosemite National Park glows orange at sunset each February typically attracts thousands of spectators. But it likely won't occur this year. Park officials said the waterfall had run dry following California's drought. Third item, Oxfam deputy chief resigns. Oxfam's deputy chief, Penny Lawrence, has resigned as the British charity faces a scandal over its response to sexual misconduct allegations involving workers who were stationed in Haiti following the 2010 earthquake. final item. Peter Rabbit film causes controversy. The producers of the new Peter Rabbit movie have apologized over a scene that seems to make light of food allergies. In the film, a character suffering from a blackberry allergy is assailed by bunnies with berries, which prompted a social media backlash. On this page, and subsection again, is World, and the headline is Time's Up for Daylight Saving. This article by Tara John, and she says, the European Parliament called for an investigation into daylight saving time on health grounds on February 8th, following other legislatures scrutinizing the practice of changing clocks every year. Here is more, and Tara John lists three items. First item, the European case. Critics of moving clocks an hour forward every summer say it disrupts human biorhythms. Supporters say the practice has benefits like preventing traffic accidents. And a 2014 study found that the overwhelming majority of EU member states were happy with it. Second item, the American case. In the U.S., states that wish to end daylight saving time must petition Congress, as Arizona did in 1968. But some states want DST to last all year. California and Florida are either considering or pushing bills that would move the clocks an hour forward permanently. Final item, the Russian case. Russia switched to permanent winter time in 2014 after a failed experiment to put clocks on year-round summer time in 2011. The policy apparently caused health issues in northern Russia, where mornings would remain darker for longer during the winter months. That was the entire article from Tara John. On the facing page, under activism, the headline is, A Me Too Moment for Muslim Women by Lanier Baron. Using the hashtag of Mosque Me Too, Muslim women have begun to speak up online about sexual abuse experienced while on the Hajj, the annual Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca, and in other religious spaces like mosques. Here's more. And Lanis Baron lists three items. First item, the spark. An unidentified Pakistani woman took to Facebook in February to write about the repeated sexual harassment she encountered while on the Hajj in Mecca. A mandatory religious obligation for Muslims, the Hajj is a five-day pilgrimage undertaken by about 2 million Muslims each year. The woman subsequently deleted her post, but it encouraged women across the world to share their own stories on social media platforms. Second item, the hashtag. As women's accounts of being poked, pinched, groped, and in other ways sexually violated on the Hajj began to snowball, social media users converged with the hashtag of MosqueMeToo. Egyptian-American feminist Mona Eltawi set the hashtag in motion by sharing her own experience of sexual assault on the Hajj at the age of 15. Her tweet was shared more than 2,000 times in 24 hours. Final item, the backlash. Eltawi said on Twitter that when she first spoke out about being assaulted on the Hajj, Muslim women told her to keep quiet, or else she would, quote, make Muslims look bad, unquote. Similarly, critics on social media have responded to Mosque Me Too by suggesting the women are tools of Islamophobia or Western propaganda. Supporters say Muslim women cannot stay silent and continue to suppress the issue of assault in order to avoid negative characterizations of Muslims. Entire article by Lehner Baron. That brings us also to the milestones feature. Under Died, John Harry Barlow, digital rights activist. Observation by Tim Berners-Lee. Time notes, Berners-Lee is a British computer scientist who invented the World Wide Web and founder of the World Wide Web Foundation. Tim Berners-Lee writes about John Perry Barlow, "People will remember John Perry Barlow, the digital rights activist and co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who died on February 7th at 70, in different ways. Some will remember him through his poetry. Those who are fans of music will remember him through his lyrics for the Grateful Dead. When I found out he had died, I got 6 Grateful Dead CDs and put them in the 6 slots in the car so that they would play one after the other. However, from a selfish point of view, I would point to his work defending the open web as his main legacy." In 1996, he wrote a manifesto, A Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, which people look back on now as the definitive cyber utopia statement. He believed that with tech, we can make the world a whole lot better. He imagined everybody connected, building a place of love and mutual assistance and understanding. I don't think he was naive. I think he was very grounded in reality. He could see things from many sides and was prepared to go to all kinds of places for his message. But he made an extreme statement which people still find really valuable. You could argue that Barlow's dreams are needed even more today, in 2018, than when he wrote that manifesto. We're a long, long way from the utopia of peace, love, and understanding, and we need people more than ever to evangelize for technology and for the good. Observance by Tim Berners-Lee on John Perry Barlow. This story is accompanied by a black and white half shot of Barlow, and the caption says, half length shot, caption says, Barlow, pictured at the PC Forum Convention in Tucson, Arizona in 1991. Under died, leading Pakistani human rights activist and lawyer, Asma Jahangir, who chaired her country's Human Rights Commission at 66. Under died, baseball player Wally Moon, the outfielder whose moonshot home runs helped the Dodgers win the 1959 World Series at 87. Under died, post-war American crooner Vic Damone, who sang the title track for An Affair to Remember, 1956-1957, starring Cary Grant, at 89. The year for An Affair to Remember was 1957, starring Cary Grant. Vic Damone died at 89. Under sued, Harvey Weinstein and his company by the state of New York over allegations of not protecting workers from, quote, pervasive sexual harassment, intimidation, and discrimination, unquote. Under announced, the introduction of long-awaited redhead emoji by the Unicode Consortium. Its new batch of 157 images, which also includes curly-haired characters, will be released in June. Under awarded, $6.7 million by a federal judge to 21 graffiti artists whose works at the Five Points Complex in Long Island City, New York, were painted over without warning in 2013. On the facing page, under diplomacy, the headline is, Where the Streets Have New Names. A member of the Russian parliament has proposed that the street on which the U.S. Embassy in Moscow sits to be renamed, quote, North American Dead End, unquote. It's not the only example of street name diplomacy rankling governments around the world. This mini article by Dan Stewart. Dan Stewart lists three examples left to right. First example, on the left, U.S. The Russian proposal was a direct response to Washington authorities, who last year voted to rename a strip of Wisconsin Avenue so that the Russian embassy is now at, number one, Boris Nemtsov Plaza, a tribute to a fervent critic of President Vladimir Putin, who was shot dead in Moscow in 2015. Middle item, Turkey. City authorities in Ankara have proposed changing the name of the street where the U.S. embassy sits to, quote, Olive Branch, unquote. Although it sounds like a peaceful gesture, that's the name of a military operation against Kurdish militia in Syria who are backed by the U.S. Final item, Iran. In 2016, Tehran officials moved to rename the Saudi Arabian embassy's location Sheikh Al-Nimr Street after an executed Shiite cleric. This wasn't a first. In 1981, the UK embassy built a new rear door after the street at its front was renamed for an IRA prisoner who died on hunger strike. On this page also is another edition of the regular feature Ticker. The sidebar feature is a sidebar this time. Again, four news items stacked top to bottom. Top item. Charges suggested for Netanyahu. Israeli police have recommended that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be charged with, quote, bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, unquote, in two cases. One involving the receipt of gifts, and the other an alleged mutual agreement with the publisher of Israeli daily, Yediot Aronot. Second item. School shooting in Florida. A gunman opened fire on February 14th at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, causing multiple fatalities. By late in the day, a suspect was in custody. Already in 2018, there have been more than a dozen school shootings in the U.S. Third item, Vanessa Trump taken to hospital. Vanessa Trump was brought to a New York City hospital as a precaution after she opened an envelope addressed to her husband, Donald Trump Jr., that contained a mysterious white powder. Early tests suggested the powder was not toxic. Final item. Men will live as long as women. Men will live as long as women by 2032, per a study conducted by Cass Business School in London. Both are predicted to have an average life expectancy of 87.5 years at that point, 2032. And moving ahead, and we are now at the major section called The View. The subsection is Society. The headline is, When the Court of Public Opinion Begins to Favor Women, by Susanna Schwabsdorf. To all the men who are worried since the start of the Me Too that their careers and reputations could be shattered by mere allegations, as the president put it recently, I'd like to say, welcome to the club. Even before social media made slander user-friendly, a woman's reputation could be destroyed with a single cruel rumor or photo. Maligning her character or sexual behavior can neutralize a woman's accomplishments and her grievances. That threat has kept us quiet and cautious about whom we challenge and why. Till now, the court of public opinion has been harsher on women than on men. There, a man's talent or value as artist, politician, or executive, especially a white one, was weighed against his personal transgressions. More often than not, many people, including women, who are often complicit, have chosen to ignore or wall off ugly, abusive behavior from professional competence. but those walls are increasingly porous. Cruelty, deception, and corruption inevitably leak through and taint the work and the lives of all those associated. Many of the executives, artists, and politicians toppled by Me Too were already known to be bullies or harassers. Those open secrets didn't wreck their careers if they were making money for someone or fulfilling some need. Instead, the people around them suffered. Those who openly resisted men, like accused rapist Harvey Weinstein, say it was their careers that took a hit, and that standing up made it hard for them to rise in their field. Again, in the interest of time, so we can get to as much material as possible, we move forward. This feature is Quick Talk, a mini-interview. The subject of the interview is Vice Admiral, Philip G. Sawyer, the commander of the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet, which is based in Japan, oversees America's largest forward-deployed maritime force. Mini-interview conducted by Feliz Solomon. Question 1. How concerned are you about Chinese militarization in the South China Sea? Answer. Well, I think even Chinese President Xi Jinping said they were not going to militarize these islands on the South China Sea. We do see progress being made, buildings being constructed and other things. They've come out and said what they will not do, so at the government level, we need to check their homework. Question. What would be the role of the 7th Fleet in nuclear warfare? Answer. I don't really have a role in nuclear conflict, which is up to Strategic Command in Nebraska and our leadership back in D.C. I don't envision a nuclear conflict in the foreseeable future. I just don't think that's a plausible scenario. Question. Two Navy ships in the Pacific had collisions last year, killing 17 sailors. What are the lessons to be learned? Answer. I think it's important to recognize that the accidents, while they were tragic, were also preventable. We should not forget, as we move forward, that we lost 17 sailors' lives, and that's one of the motivators for getting things right. As a military leader, the treasures we have are the sons and daughters, mothers and fathers, the nieces and nephews of the American populace. There's a covenant. Families provide their treasure to us as a military, and our job is to defend the homeland and to make sure we take care of the people that are entrusted to us. What I'm doing with my team in the very near term on those things that I can uniquely control is scheduling, making things deliberate and predictable to make sure we carve out time for maintenance, training, and certification. Question. When the false alarm about a ballistic missile launch was sent in Hawaii, where were you and what went through your mind? Answer. I was actually traveling that day to Hawaii. I found out just after the fact. I certainly understand the angst it caused. Last question. If the alarm were real, what would have happened? Answer. Well, without getting into classified information, there are procedures. Clearly, if the U.S. was attacked, it changes whatever I had planned to do that day. Quick Talk, conducted by Feliz Solomon with Vice Admiral Philip G. Sawyer. And this story is accompanied by a half-length full-color photo, and the caption says, Vice Admiral Sawyer assumed his post on August 23rd. On the facing page, under advice, the headline is, What to Say to a Rude Person, by Danny Wallace. Time says, Wallace is the author of F You Very Much. He writes, Recently, as the British doctor Lord Robert Winston took a train from London to Manchester, he found himself becoming steadily enraged. A woman had picked up her phone and begun a loud conversation which would last an unbelievable hour. Furious, Winston began to tweet about the woman. He took her picture and sent it to his more than 40,000 followers. When the train arrived at its destination, Winston bolted. He had had enough of the woman's rudeness. But the press were now waiting for her on the platform. And when they gleefully showed her the Lord's messages, she used just one word to describe Winston's actions. Rude. Winston's tale is something of a microcosm of our age of increasing rudeness, fueled by social media, parenthetically, and often politics. What can we do to fix this? Studies have shown that rudeness spreads quickly and virally, almost like the common cold. Just witnessing rudeness makes it far more likely that we, in turn, will be rude later on. Once infected, we are more aggressive, less creative, and worse at our jobs. The only way to end a strain is to make a conscious decision to do so. We must have the guts to call it out face to face. We must say, quote, just stop, unquote. For Winston, that would have meant approaching the woman, telling her that a conversation was frustrating other passengers, and politely asking her to speak more quietly or make the call at another time. There is more to this article by Danny Wallace, and we must move on in pursuit of more material. And that brings us to In the Nation. The headline is, Donald Trump's Forgotten Man. Blue-collar workers won him the election, they're still waiting for him to deliver. By Molly Ball, Dateline, Coatesville, Pennsylvania. Donald Trump was saying everything Vonnie Long wanted to hear, not that Long believed him. The head of the United Steelworkers Local Union in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, Long was sitting in his electrical maintenance truck in June 2016, listening on the radio to Trump give a speech on trade at an aluminum plant on the other side of the state, outside Pittsburgh. Trump had begun with a tribute to the steelworkers who built America. He blasted the politicians who pursued globalization and pledged to fight unfair trade practices that threatened U.S. jobs. Most of all, he made promises from renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, parenthetically NAFTA, to imposing a tariff on steel. Long, a stout man with a bristly gray mustache, was impressed. Republicans didn't usually talk like this. Quote, any of us steel workers could have given that exact speech, unquote, he told me recently. And while Long, a Democrat, voted against Trump, after the election, he hoped that Trump might actually follow through. But it hasn't panned out that way. A year into Trump's term, the factories have not roared back. His accomplishments, a massive corporate tax cut, a strong stock market, have largely redounded to the benefit of the bankers and fat cats. Trump has taken few of his promised actions on trade and manufacturing. The American steel industry has suffered as the market floods with imports, forcing prices down, all while the administration dithers and delays over tariffs. As Long sees it, no one should feel more betrayed by the Trump presidency than the archetypal Trump supporter, the white working-class voter whom Trump dubbed the Forgotten Man. And yet, to his great frustration, many of his fellow blue-collar workers don't seem to grasp how Trump has abandoned them. And again, moving on to yet more material in this issue. And now we are at, now we come to the science-backed secrets to living longer are far more fun than you think. This special report is entitled Longevity. This story is entitled How to Live Longer, Better. Parenthetically, you're still going to die, though. Article by Jeffrey Kluger and Alexandra Schifferlin. They say, old age demands to be taken very seriously, and it usually gets its way. It's hard to be cavalier about a time of life defined by loss of vigor, increasing frailty, rising disease risk, and failing cognitive faculties. Then there's the unavoidable matter of the end of consciousness and the self. Death, in other words. And that's drawing closer and closer. It's the rare person who can confront the final decline with flippancy or ease. That, as it turns out, might be our first mistake. Humans are not alone in facing the ultimate reckoning, but we're the only species, as far as we know, who spends its whole life knowing death is coming. A clam dredged from the ocean off Iceland in 2006 and inadvertently killed by the scientists who discovered it, carried growth lines on its shell indicating it had been around since 1499. That was enough time for 185,055 generations of mayfly, which live as little as a day, to come and go. Neither clam nor fly gave a thought to that mortal death. Humans fall somewhere between those two extremes. Globally, the average lifespan is 71.4 years. For a few lucky people, it may exceed 100 years. It has never, to scientists' knowledge, exceeded the 122 years, 164 days, lived by Frenchwoman Jean Calment, who was born when Ulysses S. Grant was in the White House and died when Bill Clinton lived there. 122 years, 164 days. Most of us would like a little bit of that Calment magic, and we've made at least some progress. Life expectancy in the U.S. exceeds the global average, clocking in at just under 79 years. In 1900, it was just over 47 years. The extra decades came courtesy of just the things you'd expect: vaccines, antibiotics, sanitation, and improved detection and treatment of a range of diseases. Advances in genetics and in our understanding of dementia are helping to extend our factory warranties still further. None of that, however, changes the way we contemplate the end of life, often with anxiety and asceticism, practicing a sort of existential bartering. We can narrow our experiences and give up indulgences in exchange for a more guardedly lived life that might run a little longer. But what if we could take time off some of that bubble wrap? What about living longer and actually having some fun? A Yale University study just this month found that in a group of 4,765 people with an average age of 72, those who carried a gene variant linked to dementia but also had positive attitudes about aging were 50% less likely to develop the disorder than people who carried the gene but faced aging with more pessimism or fear. There may be something to be said, then, for aging less timidly, as a sort of happy contrarian, arguing when you feel like arguing, playing when you feel like playing. Maybe you want to pass up the quiet of the country for the churn of a city. Maybe you want to drink a little, eat a rich meal, have some sex. Quote, the most important advice we offer people about longevity is throw away your lists, unquote, says Howard Friedman, professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and co-author of The Longevity Project. Quote, we live in a self-help society full of lists. Lose weight. Hit the gym. So why aren't we all healthy? People who live a long time can work hard and play hard under the right circumstances. Oh, reader error. That quotation ends with, people who live a long time can work hard and play hard, unquote. Under the right circumstances, it increasingly seems so could all of us. And for clarification, and with apologies from reader, that book again, The Longevity Project, author Howard Friedman, professor of psychology. And moving ahead, we come to this article, Secrets of the World's Longest Living People. Global life expectancy averages out to 71.4 years. That means, of course, that some parts of the world see much shorter lifespans, while others enjoy far greater longevity. Five places in particular fall into the latter category. They're known as blue zones, named for the blue circles researchers drew to identify the first one on a map. And they're home to some of the oldest and healthiest people in the world. Dan Buettner, author of The Blue Zones and The Blue Zones Solution, told Time why residents of these places live so long and how you can steal their secrets. Five places are listed, left to right. Number one, Sardinia, Italy. A largely plant-based diet, daily physical activity, and familial closeness have given this blue zone the highest concentration of male centenarians in the world. Parenthetically, sheep herders, who tend to walk at least 5 miles a day, and men with daughters, who may get especially tender care as they age, live even longer than most in this area. It also doesn't hurt that the M26 marker, MELA 26, mile 26, a genetic variant linked to extreme longevity, has been passed down through generations in this secluded community. Sardinia, Italy. Number two, Okinawa, Japan. Many blue zones emphasize family and community, but bonding reaches its peak in this Japanese culture. Okinawans are supported by their Okinawans are supported by their moai, a small but tight-knit social circle meant to be there through all of life's ups and downs, which provides social support strong enough to dull mental stressors and reinforce shared healthy behaviors. The result? A culture that boasts the longest living women in the world, with many surpassing 100. That term, that Japanese term, moai, that's spelled M-O-A-I, moai. Number three, Nicoya or Nisoya, Costa Rica. Most Blue Zone residents avoid processed food, but Nisoyans take it to another level. The Costa Rican people traditionally get the majority of their caloric intake from beans, squash, and corn, plus tropical fruits. This plant-forward, nutrient-dense diet, and plenty of time outdoors, makes for strong, well-nourished bodies. Meanwhile, a plan de vida, or guiding life purpose, helps Nisoyana stay mentally and spiritually fulfilled to age 90 and beyond. Nisoya, Costa Rica. Number four, Loma Linda, California, USA. The U.S.'s only blue zone is a haven for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, a Protestant denomination. A shared set of principles, emphasis on community, and adherence to the Sabbath, a day of rest, reflection, and recharging, help Loma Linda Adventists live 10 years longer than their fellow Americans. Many avoid meat and eat plenty of plants, whole grains, and nuts. Loma Linda, California. Final destination, Icaria, Greece. A fierce sense of island pride keeps Icarians invested in their community. That, combined with late bedtimes offset by daily naps and strict adherence to the Mediterranean diet, eating lots of fruits, vegetables, beans, whole grains, potatoes, and olive oil, propels one in three Icarians to live into their 90s, often free of dementia and chronic disease. entire article based on input from Dan Buettner. Dan Buettner is spelled B-U-E-T-T-N-E-R, first name Dan, author of The Blue Zones and The Blue Zones Solution, two books. Also, in this special section, and we see this article called Taking the Plunge. People are swimming in frigid water for fun and for health. Forget dipping your toe in the deep end. In countries around the world, intrepid swimmers of all ages plunge into ice-cold waters for a thrill that can feel as sharp as daggers and bragging rights that last all winter. Welcome to the fun and frigid world of cold water swimming. The hobby is nothing new. It's been around for centuries in chilly climes such as Russia and Finland, and people have been crossing the notoriously frosty 21-mile-long English Channel without wetsuits since at least the 1800s. The Coney Island Polar Bear Club hosted its first U.S. ocean dip in 1903. And while polar plunges have become relatively common, some of these swims are not for the faint of heart. Only 11 people in recorded history, for example, have completed the so-called Ice Zero, a mile-long swim in freezing water held in places such as Antarctica, Russia, and Northern Europe. Communal cold water plunges are a great way to build camaraderie and chase better health. Jitka Tufarova, 76, belongs to a swimming club in the Czech Republic. She says she has not gotten sick since she began cold water swimming. Quote, "The last time I had flu was 25 years ago," unquote. She says, quote, "My back pain disappeared. Better blood circulation improves healing broken bones, and my heart is like a hammer. I feel great," unquote. She and like-minded swimmers may be onto something. Research has shown that swimming, the kind done in normal temperature water at least, is one of the best full-body workouts. It's also ideal for older people and those with pain. Swimming is not a weight-bearing activity, but it still delivers all the benefits of traditional aerobics, from strengthening the heart to brightening mood. Scant research has explored the practice of swimming in cold water, but there is some evidence that it invigorates the body in unique ways. In a February case report published in the BMJ, a young man, desperate for relief from chronic nerve pain, went for a minute-long swim in chilly 51-degree Fahrenheit water. His pain immediately vanished and didn't return. Quote, "When I came out of the water, I realized the neuropathic pain had gone away," unquote, he told researchers, who believe the shock of cold water could have somehow disrupted pain patterns in his body. Quote, "I couldn't believe it," unquote. Another study in 2008 suggested that taking cold showers could ease depression symptoms and pain, possibly by raising levels of mood-regulating and pain-killing chemicals in the blood and brain. And moving ahead to make sure that we get more material in, this item is called Do Religious People Live Longer? By Jamie Ducharme. If a long life is what you're after, going to church may be the answer to your prayers. A number of studies have shown associations between attending religious services and living a long time. One of the most comprehensive, published in JAMA, Internal Medicine, in 2016, found that women who went to any kind of religious service more than once a week had a 33% lower chance than their secular peers of dying during the 16-year study follow-up period. Another study, published last year in PLOS-1, found that regular service attendance was linked to reductions in the body's stress responses and even in mortality. So much so that worshippers were 55% less likely to die during the up to 18-year follow-up period than people who didn't frequent the temple, church, or mosque. You don't have to become a nun to get these health benefits, however. The simple act of congregating with a like-minded community might deserve much of the credit. Tyler Vanderweel, one of the authors of the JAMA study and a professor of epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, says factors related to church-going, like having a network of social support, an optimistic attitude, better self-control, and a sense of purpose in life, may account for the long life benefits seen in his study and others. Indeed, it's also the values drawn from religious tradition, such as, quote, respect, compassion, gratitude, charity, humility, harmony, meditation, and preservation of health, unquote, that seem to predict longevity, not the dogma preached at the altar, says Howard Friedman, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and co-author of the book, The Longevity Project. Fostering these qualities may even affect rates of chronic disease, says Marino Bruce, a co-author of the PLOS-1 study and the Research Associate Professor of Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. Quote, having that sense that you're not in the world alone, that you are part of a power larger than oneself, can give one confidence to deal with the issues of life, unquote, Bruce says. Quote, biologically, if that reduces stress, then that means you're less likely to have high blood pressure or diabetes or things that can increase mortality, unquote. But what if organized religion isn't your style? Can solo prayer or even a more abstract sense of faith or spirituality provide the same payoff? It's difficult to say with certainty, because going to church is easier to measure than the intimate, individual way a person might practice religion. And the research on praying has been mixed. Some studies have found that prayer can improve disease outcomes and prolong survival, while others have been less conclusive. One 2006 study, published in the American Heart Journal, even found that people who knew they were being prayed for before undergoing heart surgery were more likely to experience complications than people who didn't know whether they were in others' prayers. But prayer has been shown to be powerful in at least one way. It triggers a relaxation response, a state of mind-body rest that has been shown to decrease stress, heart rate, and blood pressure, alleviate chronic disease symptoms, and even change gene expression. This state is typically linked to activities like meditation and yoga, and research suggests it can also be found through praying. Given that uncertainty and the accumulating evidence supporting communal religious participation, Vanderweel says solitary practitioners might want to consider congregating every once in a while. Quote, might you be missing out on something, the power of religion and spirituality, by not participating communally, unquote, Vanderweel says. Quote, that's not saying you should have religious beliefs to live longer. That's saying you already hold these beliefs. Maybe it would be worthwhile to consider communal participation, unquote. Also on this page, in the sidebar, pro tip. It's a quotation from Joe Barreca, 95, former bankruptcy lawyer, Seattle. And the quotation is, quote, everything seems to be in that prayer that Jesus taught us. Lead us not into temptation. During the generation that I lived in, A lot of people had the habit of smoking cigarettes, but I didn't smoke. Moderation is the way to enjoy things. One pie can feed 16 people. Unquote. That under pro tip. This article is entitled, Is a Pig Organ Transplant in My Future? Making human tissue in a lab has always been more sci-fi than sci-fact, but powerful genetic technologies may change that soon. Article by Alice Park, with reporting by Alexandra Sifferlin. For the most part, the only way to replace diseased or failing hearts, lungs, kidneys, and livers is with donor organs. Even then, many people struggle to find a good biological match with a donor, and 8,000 die each year in the U.S. while waiting for an organ. And one promising solution to the shortage? Researchers have been putting a new DNA editing tool called CRISPR through rigorous tests in organ regeneration. Last August, a group of scientists led by George Church, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, generated more than a dozen pigs that were bred without certain viruses that had made many of their organs unusable for human transplant. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long until next time, please join us for Time Magazine.